From the studios of KPCW in Park City, Utah, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, well, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our first guest this morning is Cool Science Radio's personal astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is a best-selling author, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, and the Emmy-nominated host of the Star Talk podcast. Neil's latest book is Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization. This new book brings the rationality of science and the scientific mind to look at the political and cultural issues we talk about every day.
We look forward to that conversation. Always love talking with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Our second guest this morning is award-winning science journalist Mara Grunbaum. Mara has written a new book called Breakdown. It's a Nat Geo kids book. It's filled with incredible photos and fun facts and covers all kinds of things that crash, crumble, and break.
Lynn and I want to update you on a story we've been reporting on for the last 2 years. DART, DART is the acronym, and it stands for NASA's Double Asteroid Redirection Test Spacecraft. Whew. Anyway, DART was intentionally smashed into the asteroid Dimorphos this past Monday night after a 10-month journey to track and intercept the asteroid.
Well, this mission, again, launched in November of last year, demonstrates a way for humanity to protect itself from asteroids. It really sounds like a science fiction movie, but it's so exciting, John. I love it. While Dimorphos itself had not been on course to crash into Earth, the mission demonstrates NASA's ability to deflect similar asteroids in the future.
NASA Administrator and guest on Cool Science Radio, Bill Nelson, called the mission an unprecedented success for planetary defense. He goes on to say that the next step is to study the asteroid using telescopes on Earth to confirm that DART's impact actually altered its orbit.
It'll be interesting to see if it did alter it and to what degree. Cool Science Radio will continue to monitor the DART program. When we post this story to the kpcw.org site, we'll include the live stream video of DART's final seconds before crashing into Dimorphos, which is 6.8 million miles away. And I just have to say that whenever you see videos of something like this happening, and the video is on the control room, and you can feel the palpable excitement in the room, and everyone cheers when it strikes the asteroid, and it's so worth looking up, isn't it, John?
Yeah, I mean, hitting it is one thing, but tracking the thing down 6.8 miles and basically doing a bullseye, you know, within 5 minutes of the original objective time frame. It's very exciting. Anyway, our guest is astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is a best-selling author, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, and the Emmy-nominated host of the Star Talk podcast. Neil's latest book is Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization. This new book brings the rationality of science and the scientific mind to look at the political and the cultural issues that we talk about every day. Neil, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks. It's been too long. Has I not been cool enough for you to be on Cool Science Radio in the last few years?
I know, and you are our personal astrophysicist at Cool Science Radio, so we really appreciate that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah. Why don't we start with this, because this book is a departure from your other books. Tell us why you wrote this book and how you organized it.
So the motive... sorry, I'm outdoors and there's an airplane flying overhead. This is what it is to be in civilization. You had, 100 years ago, they said, wow, we can fly, you know. So this book has been gestating within me since I've been scientifically literate. And I would date that from early middle school, where I'd walk around life and I'd see grown-ups who I think should know better, saying things, doing things that just made no sense, where they believed they had some deeply formed view on how the world works. And that was just not the case. And I said, how rampant is this? And so I kept sort of silent records of what I saw happening in our societal, cultural, political systems. And I, you know, most of it I let go because if it, you know, if it's harmless, why bother? But at some point I was pregnant with this, having gestated my whole life, and it was time for this to give birth. And so Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization, is a lifetime's reflections on what we do, why we do it as a society, as a civilization, and it shows you that there are other ways to think about arguments that you may have had with others at the Thanksgiving table, the dinner table that you have over social media. There are ways to see so many arguments, not from the middle where you're compromising, that could be a solution as well, but cosmic perspectives force you to take a few steps higher. And then you look back down on the arguments you were constructing and realize maybe you didn't have arguments at all. And maybe your quote opponent also didn't have arguments, and that you can meet in a new place. Mm. And birth a new era of tranquility and peace in the world. That's all I'm trying to accomplish with the book.
That's all. Well, the scientific process is not perfect, but boy, does it work well. And it's worked well for many, many years. What can the scientific process tell us about truth and the consensus by our peers?
Yeah, that's an important question. In fact, the book leads off with just a full description and discussion of what the word truth means. I didn't try to take control over the word because many people use the word, especially religions. If you look up the word truth, it's often associated with what religions can do for you. And it's on their Bible posters, this sort of thing. So I wasn't going to take that away. What I did was I added nuance to the word truth. So if you have a personal truth, for example, that Jesus is your savior, or Abraham is your prophet, or Muhammad is the last of all prophets. If you have some personal truth and you are certain this is the case, in a free society, especially in the United States, where religious views are protected, no one's going to take that away from you. The problem is if somebody else has a different personal truth, if you rise to power over laws or legislation and then create laws that have to apply to everyone else in this pluralistic land, that is the seeds of unrest. And so, all right, that's one kind of, another kind of truth I'd call political truths. These are truths that just become true because you heard them repeated. Okay. It's the seeds of propaganda. That's how propaganda works. You just start saying it, and the brain doesn't know how to interpret it. It begins to think that if you hear it a lot, it must be true, and it gets deep inside of you, and then you adopt it as truth. There's another kind of truth I call objective truth. This is what the methods and tools of science are exquisitely tuned to establish. These are the operations of nature that are true whether or not you believe in them. And it seems to me, if you're going to make laws based on anything, it should be on objective truths in a pluralistic country where everybody lives within the laws of the universe, okay? The laws of chemistry, physics, biology, and astrophysics. So I should have some foundation there. Otherwise, again, it's the seeds of unrest. And if you want to promote tranquility in the world, we need to be thinking more along these lines. And let me just say, let me abstract for you the scientific method, right? You could read this, hypothesis testing. Yes, that's all true, but I think I have a better way to think about it. Here it is. It's in one sentence. Do whatever it takes to not fool yourself into thinking something is true that is not, or that something is not true that is. Period. Do whatever it takes. It means taking notes, taking video, chart recorders, double checking, verifying that maybe you have a bias and someone else doesn't. Maybe you both have biases. Get a third person. Get someone who's using different wall current. Is it 120 volts, 240? Maybe the machine acts differently, design a different kind of machine, just to make sure you're not fooling yourself and not being influenced by bias that is so pervasive in everything we do in our lives. And one thing good thing about science is, one of the many things, is that we know in advance that we risk bias. And so part of the scientific, the genesis of the scientific method is to reduce that risk as far as possible, if not to zero.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with our own personal astrophysicist, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. He has written a new book called Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization. As you've been talking, Neil, I've been thinking about those yard signs that you see that in some people's yards that say, we believe in science. You know, in this house, we believe in science. No one is illegal, you know, on and on and on. And I always wonder, so is believing in science then believing, truly believing in the scientific method, believing that science can be faulty and mistaken and biased and all of that? And I think my question is, you know, what is believing in science then? Do you
it's a malformed bumper sticker.
Okay.
Science is not about belief. It doesn't matter what you believe. Belief has no role in this. You could, so here's, let me be a little more sensitive to people who feel that way. People say, do I believe in the Big Bang? And I'll say, I apportion my confidence in whether something's true according to how much supportive evidence there is for it. So generally in our society, when we use the word belief, it almost always implies it's something you think is true in the absence of evidence. But if you have evidence to support your thought, then it's not belief. It's confidence in the evidence. Now, on the bleeding frontier, moving frontier of science, where we don't have enough data really to know if one thing is true or another, at science conferences, there's a lot of contested ideas going on there. And do you know the difference, though? At a scientific conference, when I'm having an argument with you, there's an unwritten truth about that argument. We both go into that argument knowing either I'm right and you're wrong, you're right and I'm wrong, or we're both wrong. Okay. And generally those arguments are, you leave them off by saying, here's how we need to get better data to decide. And then we bring in someone else who's good at experiments and observations, whatever, and then it becomes a collaboration. And then this is how science increments forward. So it's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of, is the evidence compelling or not?
When you said scientific conference, it reminded me of the story in your book about the 4,000 physicists that go to a conference that was supposed to be held in San Diego or somewhere, and it ends up being held in Las Vegas. And this is the chapter on risk and reward and how the casino did not profit over that weekend.
Yeah, if there was a headline that said a casino profits lowest ever. The American Physical Society, which is the community of the nation's physicists, has been asked to never return to Las Vegas. So you can ask, well, did they know how to bet in some secret way? No. Why do you have casinos? Because the human mind is not really wired to think statistically and probabilistically about the world. And that gets us into so much trouble. People saying, oh, there's no such thing as coincidences. It's ordained into the day's activities. Or you'd be at the roulette table. I'm betting on 7. Why? Well, it's due. There hasn't been a 7 in a long time. They even show you the recent rolls and where it came, feeding this gap in our ability to understand and interpret probability. So I'm sad for civilization that an entire industry, the casino industry, has risen up to exploit the fact that we have a weakness there in our capacity to know what is and is not true and what is likely or not likely to happen. And I'm saddened by that. It's very exploitive. And here's something, you know, all we have to do is teach probability and statistics in K through 12. It's not really there. It's there in kind of like elective, okay? But it's not part of the basic curriculum. And by the way, where in many states, where do lottery profits go? Do you remember?
Education.
They go to education. Yeah. And so I have this fantasy that part of the education money from lotteries goes to teach people about probability and statistics, but then they don't end up going to the to the thing that's actually paying for the program that teaches them probability and statistics. So the book is filled with examples of just things we do, whereas if you looked at it scientifically or a little more analytically or with less passion of opinion, that you'll land in a different place. If I could slip in another quick example, I know we're running short on time here, but I have a whole chapter on meat eaters and vegetarians. Like, that was like the funnest chapter to write, by the way, because they're always at odds with each other, always. And so there's some playful takes on that conflict as well in that chapter. But one of them is maybe you're a vegetarian because you don't want to kill animals. Okay, no one's going to take that from you. So you own a humane mousetrap in your basement, and you trap the mouse because you don't want to snap its neck. You got to check on it every few days because mice don't last long without water, so they dry up pretty quickly. So you check it. There it is. What do? You put it out in the wild, setting it free, where it is doomed to be eaten by owls, foxes, all manner of woodland predators within 9 to 18 months of its life.
Yeah.
Where? So the safest thing to do for your mouse is leave it in your basement. It'll live 6 years in your basement, right? But you're not doing that. So do you really care about the longevity of the mouse? Or are you virtue signaling that you, I mean, where does this land? So I'm just trying to get people thinking a little more deeply about their actions.
And one of the things that I really love about the scientific process is that there are consequences. And if you misinterpret your facts, it will certainly be called out on you as your peers look at that. If you misrepresent your facts, your data, it could ruin your career.
Yeah, it does. It would end your career. It's mistakes. If you get something wrong, not a problem on the frontier. Mm-hmm. Most things published will ultimately be shown to be wrong when new data comes along. If you made a mistake, all right, we'll give you a few more chances. You know, you forgot to dot the, you know, to carry the two in your equation. Mm-hmm. That's why there's peer review, to try to help you not make simple mistakes like that. But if there's outright fraud or faking of data, which would be fraud, and that gets discovered, that's basically the end of your career.
Yeah.
So science has a built-in mechanism for the integrity of its participants. Mm. And that's why respect for science, I mean, it used to be very high. I think when people had access to Google search engines and they can spend a full hour researching something, they can become experts like someone who spent 8 years getting a degree. And so they will say, no, I know better than you know. And that's, so it gives people a false sense of power of knowledge. That's a whole other conversation.
You know, your book is chock full of lots of ideas. One of the ideas is to take something that you believe in, supported by data, and examine the facts that inform that belief. And then using those same facts, see if you can support 180 degrees from your original belief. And I think that that's something worth trying.
Yeah, it's not done often enough. We try to do it in science. I mean, it's not canon, but it's frequently mentioned. Someone will come up with some result, usually at a conference, because before it's fully vetted, and say, you know, I could pose it the question this way or plot the data in this other way and arrive at the opposite conclusion or no conclusion at all. Mm-hmm. All right. And you want to be the one to have done that with your own data. You don't want anybody calling that out. So again, you want to be your own best skeptic. And with people who have strongly held formulated opinions, generally they're not skeptical of their opinions. They'll watch news stories that resonate with them. They'll buy books that continue to reinforce it. They'll do Google searches with keywords that are exactly what they believe, and they'll think that everybody thinks that way because a Google search found every website that feeds your suppositions. So I think the book is a wake-up call for people to try to form better arguments, less emotionally infused, because the moment you get emotionally attached to your argument, you shut off from ideas that could conflict with them. And that's a very natural bias that we have. We're human. I'm not complaining. I just want you to be self-aware.
Right.
And that's the start of any kind of progress in this regard.
Well, a good example of, you know, how to try not to feel is when you get those heart palpitations when someone is attacking your belief and you feel this emotion rising in you instead of saying, huh, okay, let's consider your point. And I was thinking about when you were talking about objective truths, you know, to someone who believes in a flat earth, what you're saying is how not to believe in an objective, that is an objective truth, how to know, but how do you know?
Yeah, so the flat earth people have cherry picked the data in ways where they're just choosing not to believe other evidence in support of a round earth. And so the real problem, I can give counterexamples and things, but the real problem is in K-12, where you are taught that science is a satchel of facts, period. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, this fact can be changed. Right? No, that's an aspect of science. Science is primarily a way of querying nature, skeptically. Mm-hmm. And then when you realize, by the way, skepticism is not doubting everything. It's knowing when there's sufficient data to arrive at a conclusion so then you can move on to other cases. So I can mention a couple of things. I live on the East Coast. I've seen football games that take place in California on a Sunday afternoon, but on the East, it's winter, so sun sets early. It's dark in New York City, and the sun is still up in Los Angeles for that LA Rams game, okay? And I'm thinking, but this is live. How is that? How can Earth be flat? But I'm in darkness in there. And so can you think about that? Why not think about that? And how come the shadow of Earth on the moon during a lunar eclipse is never just a flat line? It always have a curved edge to it as it moves. Just think about that, right? And so when people refuse to accept compelling data, it means they haven't been trained to know what compelling data looks and smells like. Mm. So it's a deeper problem in the school system than just running around beating people on the head, telling them what is or is not true.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be a good educator if all you did was beat them on the head and tell them they're wrong. You need a persuasive argument that recognizes where they're coming from so that you know how to navigate that, so that at the end you have successfully communicated rather than just lectured. Mm. A very important difference.
Yes.
By the way, another example of, are your ideas sort of consistent? Have you thought it through? There are people who eat line-caught tuna. I buy line-caught tuna, right? They're caught with the fishing line. Why? Because net-caught tuna, where they drag a net, very efficient and effective, you got to pay more for the line-caught tuna. But those occasionally trap an air-breathing dolphin. And dolphins suffocate because they can't go up and get a breath of air. So it protects the dolphins. But what about the tuna? You're eating tuna. Okay. You have said, I care about the dolphin, but not the tuna. I'm eating me some tuna here, okay? Oh, the dolphin is a mammal. Oh, as you eat your hamburger, okay?
Right.
We got to save dolphins. Give me some more ketchup on this burger. It tastes great. This Wagyu beef tastes... I mean, where is the self-consistency in the views that you have? And in science, that's what we do. We say, you have this view. If you have this view, does anything else have to come with it? What's separable? What is not?
Yeah.
And so the whole book is filled with that, if anyone cares.
and so realizing that a lot of our beliefs are pretty arbitrary and not related to other beliefs that we have. And this is an urging by you, this thing that was gestating in you for so long to start to recognize. I wonder why you, about the chapter on gender and identity, you know, one thing I didn't know was that Santa's reindeers, male or female, they all grow antlers.
Right. No, it's more potent than that. Reindeer, both sexes grow antlers. So In principle, Santa's reindeer could be both male and female. However, actual reindeer, actual male reindeer, lose their antlers before Christmas, and the female antlers keep theirs. So if Santa is actually flying with reindeer on Christmas Day, and if all the reindeer have antlers, they're all female, which means Rudolph has been misgendered the entire time. I got an email from someone who said, actually, in my culture, I forgot, was it in Norway? I don't remember where. Rudolph was called Rudolphina because they know, you got to be a girl if you have antlers on Christmas Day. The little things just to think about, you know, because we make assumptions. By the way, I'm not here to usurp your opinions. I want your opinions to just be more deeply informed than they might otherwise have been. So it's not a rant again. It's here you are, you know, you want to protect dolphins because they're mammals. So you've put a circle around our little part of the tree of life, and you're valuing other animals because of their proximity to us. How about the rest of the tree of life? Okay. How about the tree you cut down to make your house with the floorboards, the 2x4s, the structural members, the tree that could live 100 years, Pacific Northwest, the trees live 1,000 years. Oh, but I need wood for my table. I need wood for, like, really? Really? You're saving the 1-ounce mouse and you're cutting down the tree to build your house that the 1-ounce mouse walked into? What? Who do you think nature cares more about? The tree or the mouse? The tree, every day of its life, generates 15 times the mass of the mouse in breathable oxygen. And it's home for birds and insects and squirrels and all kinds of woodland creatures. No, you're going to cut it down to build a house to save a chubby 1-ounce mouse and then hand it over to owls.
Unfortunately, we're almost out of time.
Before too much talking. Sorry.
Oh, no, I just wanted to mention to you that we all know that astronauts that go into space have this transformative overview effect, which you write about in the book, as they view a book that doesn't have borders and has a thin blue ribbon that makes up this protective and fragile atmosphere. Knowing that every astronaut feels that way, or pretty much everyone does, and only maybe 600 out of 8 billion people on the planet have experienced it, why haven't we done something better with a really good VR experience that we could show to the planet and to get people excited about? Maybe if they love the planet, they'll take care of what they love.
Yeah, I think VR is only a fraction of the way there, because when you're in orbit, you're also weightless. So there's a certain sort of lightness of being that accompanies that perspective that you're not going to get just in a VR experience, first. But second, this is why I've advocated for, you know, the first time, maybe on one of Elon's large spaceship you see videos of, the videos where he's imagining what the future of that would be. Get one that holds maybe 100 seats and get every head of state to go on board. Put them up first, okay? Yeah. Even the most warring factions, you put them all up there, okay? Give them coffee service or whatever else they want, and let them hang weightless looking down on Earth where they cannot see their national borders. They see Earth as nature intends, with with oceans and land and clouds. And that's transformative. By the way, better yet, send them all to the moon, because then Earth shrinks down into this ball. If you're just in orbit, Earth is still kind of big beneath your feet. You go to the moon, that's when the overview effect becomes a cosmic perspective. Yeah.
Maybe leave them up there.
No.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is Cool Science Radio's personal astrophysicist. He's also just written a really good book, Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization. Neil, it's always good to see you. Always good to talk with you. We wish you continued success with this book.
Thank you both for your continued interest in what I do here. And I'll try to keep it cool. Then I get another invite back.
Yeah. Keep it cool.
You certainly will. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks, Neil.
You got it.
Our next guest is award-winning science journalist, Mara Grunbaum. Mara has written Breakdown, which is a Nat Geo's kids book. It's filled with incredible photos, fun facts, covers all sorts of things that crash, crumble, and break. Mara Grunbaum, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, we're really happy to have you here. And I'm so glad you wrote this book. As a kid, I could take things apart, but maybe only could put maybe 20% back together. But I have to say, I was tackling some pretty big things for a 8 or 9 year old. I took the furnace apart when my father was away on a business trip, and that didn't work out well. So I'm really glad you wrote this, because it sort of vindicates some of my behavior. Do a lot of kids take things apart?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you definitely weren't alone in that. You know, kids are naturally curious, and they're kind of natural scientists and engineers about it. Someone earlier was telling me about how her 4-year-old threw a rock at the car window because he needed to test if it was really glass. And it was, he found out, she found out. And now he knows. But, you know, I think it's kind of natural for kids and for humans in general to want to know how things work, and when things don't work, to want to figure out why not and what's happening and maybe how we can fix them.
And Mara, you wrote that learning is about how things come apart equally as important as knowing how they go together. So that's it's important stuff.
Yeah, I think equally or sometimes even more important, you know, if we just did things once and then never thought about it again, we would never improve anything. Or if things went wrong and we were just like, oh, well, I guess we'll never try to build a building again because one building fell down, you know, we would be in a much different place. So mistakes and disasters are definitely unfortunate sometimes, but they're one of the best ways to learn and, you know, in science and in life.
Mara, I just love this book, and I never would have thought of writing about how things break down. But again, just as you're talking about, it's so important. I think when my kids were growing up, there were lots of lawn mowers taken apart and not put back together. There were things like blenders and all that. And I thought, as a parent, what a great idea to get them in there with a screwdriver and everything. But then putting it back together, I thought, oh, somewhere I'm failing as a parent. Like, taking it apart is one thing, but like John, not being able to put the furnace back together. I mean, is the lesson for kids more in the taking it apart or putting it back together, or are both equally important?
I mean, I think there's some of both, right? And both sides of that equation are important, but it's not always the same people who do both sides, you know? One of the things that we cover in the book are sort of engineering mistakes that have happened, right? Buildings, bridges that have not held up. And those, you know, sometimes fall apart, and sometimes there's someone else who comes in and looks at that and figures out, you know, either how to put it back together or just to build a better one next time that that doesn't fall down in the same way. So, you know, I don't think it's a failure to take something apart and not be able to put it back together. I think, I'm sure your son learned something from that. I'm sure you learned something from that, maybe not to let him take things apart if they're important. you know, not everyone can do every part, but sort of as a society, we work to figure things out and move forward.
I think a book like this is so important, especially for young girls. And I'm going to extend into older girls too. I currently have one headlight out, and I said, by gosh, I'm replacing that headlight. And I think that girls just aren't raised oftentimes, and it's a shame, with this know-how of, you know, I tried with the screwdriver, with the Phillips screwdriver, and I couldn't get it off. So then I need, you know, the whatever it's called. Oftentimes I don't even know the name of the tools. And it's just, I think we need a whole reset for young girls on these sorts of things. What interested you in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very true. And I think, you know, in some ways we tend to divide things, right, into like, these are the girls or women tasks, and these are the boy and male tasks. Traditionally, but a lot of them actually have the same fundamental process of just like thinking and asking questions and problem solving. And, you know, like, as women, we're not necessarily raised to think like we should be able to fix the headlights, but like, a lot of, you know, more traditional feminine tasks in the household, like that involves a lot of engineering and problem solving and stuff too. So I think there's room for both, saying, you know, like, anyone can be interested in anything they want. Girls can be into tinkering with stuff. Boys can be into cooking. And there's also a lot of space to say, you know, like, even if you're into the traditional things associated with your gender, like, there's a lot of science and engineering in that as well. You know, for me, I think I fall kind of in between. Some of the more like mechanical stuff I've never been that inclined toward, but in researching it all for this book, I've learned a lot of cool stuff, and yeah, for me, the process itself is really interesting. You know, not necessarily like how the machines go together, although that's cool, but like how making them and remaking them and seeing how they break and putting them back together can teach us stuff over time.
Why don't we talk about one that's dear to my heart, being from Boston, the 1919 molasses flood. What happened?
Yeah, so this is one that I actually did not know about at all until I visited Boston a while ago and saw a plaque about it, and did not know about in a lot of detail until researching it for this book. But as I'm sure you know, John, this was something that happened in 1919, where a company was storing more than 12,000 tons of molasses, which they were importing a lot of at the time to sweeten beverages and things like that. And they were storing it in this tank that they had built themselves in a way that they thought was fine. They didn't bother consulting an engineer about it. You know, who needs that? And they had all this molasses stored up, and this was in January, but there was an unseasonably warm day, and fluids expand when they get warmer, right? So the molasses was kind of expanding. There were some gases building up and putting pressure on the walls of the tank. And molasses started leaking out of the seams, and some of the rivets in the tank started popping out. And eventually the whole thing exploded and released this like gush, this tidal wave of molasses over a couple city blocks. And it injured people. It broke things. It caused quite a lot of chaos. And when investigators went back and looked at it, they were able to discover all these things that the company that built the tank basically did wrong. You know, they should have used different rivets. They should have welded some of the plates together. They shouldn't have put a door into the tank right at the bottom of the tank where the fluid pressure is the greatest. And they should have asked an engineer. So after this happened, a lot of rules were put into place in Boston and elsewhere about, you know, you have to have a licensed engineer to sign off on your plans before you build something like this. You have to have someone double check your calculations and, you know, file it with the appropriate authorities. And that has been a great benefit, to come out of this kind of spectacular disaster.
Yeah, there were 150 people injured and 21 people killed, took out entire city blocks. I mean, that's a lot of molasses.
It is. And, you know, you would think it would, like, ooze really slowly, but when there's that much of it, it just, you know, there's no real getting away from it.
Yeah, they should have had Splenda. They should have used Splenda.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of people have a hard time with the permitting process and needing to get engineered, you know, an engineer to sign off on things. And there's really good reason for that. We need to remind ourselves among the frustration when we're trying to get something built. And a great example of this, shifting from East Coast to West Coast, out in your neck of the woods, Mara, is the Galloping Gertie, the bridge across the Tacoma Narrows. First time I heard this story, I was just blown away. What went wrong there?
So was the bridge.
Yeah, literally blown away.
So I'm from Washington State, which has the dubious distinction of being home to one of the most famous engineering disasters of all time, which is the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which is a bridge across this wide channel of water that we have here. They opened it to great fanfare. It was open for about 4 months. And then there was a windy day, and the wind started catching the girders on the side of the bridge, which at some point they had decided to build, just kind of just make them flat rather than having them kind of X trusses or triangular trusses because it was cheaper or easier or something. And the wind started catching these flat side panels and wobbling the bridge a little. And the more the bridge wobbled, the more the edges would catch the wind, and the wobble got bigger and bigger and bigger until it was finally kind of buckling and shaking, and it earned the nickname Galloping Gertie. Someone had the foresight to film it for the benefit of posterity. And if you've seen the video, it's wild. I mean, it's a bridge bouncing around like it's, you know, a piece of grass in the wind. Luckily, everyone was able to get off it in time, so no one actually was injured or died in this incident. And it collapsed pretty spectacularly, which is too bad. But the silver lining is that, you know, this is still something that engineering students study today. It's something that engineers pretty much immediately started learning from and changing the designs of bridges that they were working on to avoid the same thing happening again. And a new bridge was eventually built in that location, and I'm happy to say it is still standing. And we are trying here in Washington not to be infamous for that again.
You know, suspension bridges are something that just amaze me every time I see them or go across them. And I have to say, I always think of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge disaster every time I go across one of these bridges. It's just a feat of engineering that boggles my mind, really. But there, a lot was learned from that.
Yeah, totally. And that's, you know, you were talking before about sort of regulations and rules being frustrating sometimes, and that's totally understandable. But that's because, like, you know, things have gone wrong over time. And as a culture, we've tried to learn from them and put rules into place to keep them from happening, so that when we do drive over bridges now, we can mostly trust that they're not going to start buckling in the same way that Tacoma Narrows did.
Yeah, that'd be a scary video to show a kid right before you go over a bridge. That's probably wouldn't work very well. So what did you learn about this book as you were researching it that really surprised you?
Oh my gosh, there were a lot of things. One thing that was fun to figure out is just, you know, how many different people there are trying to learn from these things in so many different ways. I talked to, for instance, a skateboard quality engineer, which I did not know was a job. And, you know, he comes up with ways to imitate the battering that different skateboard parts take and mimic them in his lab and, like, test different parts to make sure that they don't wear down too fast. And, you know, that came from him just being a kid who was really into skateboards and and skated a lot and, like, saw things wear out. And then people started asking him to, like, try out new parts and stuff. And he kind of landed himself in this STEM career that, you know, is not necessarily what you think of when you think of, like, becoming a scientist. But there are all sorts of jobs like that, that, you know, are just like this little niche that someone got really curious about. And it was really fun to learn about some of those.
Public safety is so important. And there are those, and of course it's state by state. Some states have more regulations than others. Have we gone overboard in any of these areas?
Oh gosh. That's probably outside the scope of this book a little bit. And you know, I'm sure there are places where maybe we're being overcautious. But again, if that is the case, it's because there's been this whole history of things going wrong and, you know, trying to actually learn from those mistakes. And sometimes maybe we learn that making too many rules is the mistake and then we go back from there. But it's all kind of a cycle.
We're speaking with Mara Grunbaum. She's the author of a National Geographic kids book called Breakdown: Explosions, Implosions, Crashes, Crunches, Cracks, and More. It's such a great book, and it's not just for kids. I'm telling you, I'm going to put this on my coffee table, and I bet it will be the book that most adults look at before they look at any other book, because it, you know, what we're sort of expecting is that children are curious about these things. And unfortunately, a lot of times adults have, they learned about it when they were a kid and their curiosity isn't there. But as soon as it is awakened again, we go, oh yeah, what about the Leaning Tower of Pisa? You know, it's something I, you know, went to, it's a tourist attraction, but what really happened there? And this is actually one of the things that you talk about in the book. And this was also another shortcut, choosing the wrong sort of limestone or something for the foundation. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a bunch of things that went wrong with that one. They were building it over the course of, I think it ended up being several hundred years and multiple different engineers, and they ended up getting interrupted by wars and other sorts of things going on. But yeah, it was basically a series of mistakes that they tried to correct for with what turned out to be different mistakes. So they built it in a place where the ground was kind of a little too soft and squishy, and they didn't build a very strong foundation. And then when the tower started to sink in one direction, one engineer thought, well, maybe we can just make up for it by putting more bricks on the other side to kind of balance out the weight. And then it started leaning the other way. And then they tried to, you know, make the floors taller on the other side. So that's a case where maybe the actual answer was to scrap it and start over. But it's now standing, barely. They had to kind of reshift it a little while back. But it's kind of this testament to learning from mistakes as they went, and still standing there as an example of what not to do. And, you know, we can admire that as well.
And back in the 1990s, it was closed for about a decade while engineers tried to sort of shore up the foundation a bit, and yet probably not, you know, put it back up straight, because how strange that it became one of Italy's greatest tourist attractions.
Right. I think if they straightened it, no one would bother coming to look at it anymore. But they did have to do something, because I think they realized that mathematically it should not have been staying up at the angle that it was at. Like, the center of gravity was in a place where it could fall over basically any minute. So they had to adjust that a bit.
And so that's a question in and of itself, is like, why didn't it fall over when it should have?
Yeah,
it's a mystery. We have to solve that on Cool Science Radio.
There you go.
Kids love to see cars get crushed in the big crusher. All kids love that kind of thing. Is that something we should bring our kids and our grandkids to and have fun with the whole thing?
Sure, why not? That's a great example of one of the times that we sort of harness the forces of destruction for our own benefit, right? And car crushers, it turns out, are basically the same technology that we've had since the 1970s. They've made some improvements here and there, but it's basically the same hydraulic system, and some of them are so sturdy that they're still using like the actual same machines from the 1970s. But that's, you know, when you get down to it, the actual forces that work in the hydraulic system are pretty straightforward. I'm not going to try to explain the whole thing out loud, but, you know, it's a system where you press on one amount of fluid and it transfers a force to a different amount of fluid, and that makes it a force that is spread out over a greater area. And that makes it strong enough to crush a car into like a cube the size of a microwave. And that's pretty dang cool that we came up with that.
And crushing cars is really exciting, but at the same time, it's also very exciting to see a car being built. And I spent a lot of time in Detroit Motor City, going to Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors with my technology business I was in. And I was always fascinated to see raw steel coming in one end of the building and Pontiacs coming out the other end of the building. I mean, it's just an incredible process, and how all the pieces sort of fall into place. That's probably a pretty good thing to take a kid for a tour.
Sure thing. Yeah. And one of the things we talk about in the book is how those cars are designed not just to look nice and drive well, but they're actually designed with areas that are weaker on purpose, so that if there's an accident, that part of the car will kind of crunch and absorb some of the force. And that helps protect the people inside, because not as much force gets transferred to the people in an accident. So that's another really good example of, kind of learning from accidents that happen and the forces of destruction, and using that to design a car so that the car will take some of the hit so that we don't have to. And that's something that there's been a lot of advancement on in Michigan and elsewhere in the last decades, centuries.
Mara, did you have a hard time narrowing things down, or did you just include everything and then make them a little bit shorter if it was something that didn't need a full explanation?
Right. Yeah, it was definitely some of both. Like, there was a lot of brainstorming that I did with my editors at the beginning to be like, okay, what can we even, you know, like, what are the chapters going to be? What can we include in each chapter? What if we do this? What if we do this? Some of them came to me easily than others. Like, I tend to skew toward being interested in, like, life sciences and earth sciences and stuff. So, like, that chapter I had a lot of ideas about. The more machiney ones I had fewer, but my editors had more, you know. And then, you know, some things, once I started doing some research, there wasn't either wasn't that much there, or it seemed like it would be too complicated to explain. So we had to narrow down and make some swaps in. There's definitely, for the things that did make it into the book, there is more interesting information than made it into the book, which is almost always the case. But we do include also some resources where kids and parents can go learn more.
And Mara, what are the age ranges for this book? I mean, besides Lynn and I.
Right. So, I mean, it's targeted toward kind of middle grade readers. So like late elementary school, early middle school. But there's really some stuff in there for everyone. You know, it's a very visual book. There are a lot of great photos and diagrams. So even younger readers might have something to look at, and there are some like shorter fun facts and stuff if they can't get into the big blurbs. And yeah, you know, older kids, teens, adults will hopefully find something interesting in there as well.
And that was Mara Grunbaum with Nat Geo Kids. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.